Welcome back to Nota Bene. What up?
What a week it was.
Freeman.
My God.
It's a whirlwind. It's a fucking shit show. It's all of it.
We had an election. We had the biggest auction of all time. What else do we have, Benjamin?
The election feels like a million years ago, yet it's still not decided.
Yeah. It's not going to be for a while. We don't need to get into that in this podcast. There are other podcasts that you can get all year.
There's a lot of them.
There are a lot of them. I listen to some of them. A lot of them suck.
Yeah. Yeah. I try not to listen to them. Yeah. It's really dark.
It's quite dark. I mean, yeah, the sort of bro politics podcast world is outside of my interest level.
Yeah, let's get into our own bro world. Yeah. Let's get into the big bucks bro world. There ain't no money to be made in politics, but appears to be money to be made in art if you're already rich.
If you're already rich, you can afford shit like $150 million Seurat. And what else sold at this bonkers auction on Wednesday?
Baby, I don't know. You wrote Cezanne, a whole column about it, man.
Monet. Manet. It was an incredible auction to be at. I mean, honestly, we were talking earlier.
John's. I mean, let's get America.
America represented. We were talking earlier about how we were a little concerned about whether people would be interested in buying these. There's so few people in the world.
I was concerned. It was like 10 to 15 people that are going to, mm-hmm. Potential bidders for a lot of these mega bucks lots. Mm-hmm. But I was wrong.
Well, we knew that, obviously the collection itself was guaranteed by Christie's and or Mr. Pino. But then they also offloaded a lot of risk by getting third parties for, I think, 2/3 of the lots.
No, listen, there were white gloves were at the ready no matter what went mm-hmm. down over in Rockefeller Center. But
what was surprising, there was a lot of interest for some of these. I mean, like the Andrew Wyeth, which actually was getting a lot of play on Instagram in the days before, even though it was not the star lot by any measure. A lot of people really fucking liked that work, and it sold for, $20-something million.
If I were more technologically and or analytically proficient, there's something to be said in all these auctions when you can feel, based on Instagram, mm-hmm. what's getting shot the most, and not just by the type of people that are going to buy it, but just the vibe in the art world.
Exactly.
And I think there probably is some way to do some kind of some sort of analysis to kind of prefigure what might have more interest than the estimate or even the recent history for an artist would project.
Right. I think it's kind of difficult because I think, we follow a pretty, elite group of people on Instagram. So you have to kind of find all the people who or on that list and see who they follow and see which works are being...
You would have to weight them based in certain ways. I mean, as I said, not going to do it.
No, we're not going to fucking do that.
Someone could.
Free idea alert.
I mean, we saw it with Popples last season. All the best people were interested in that work, and it had a pretty good result.
The number of people who came up to me was like, why do you guys keep on talking about this fucking Popples?
Well, that was clearly someone with no fucking taste.
True,
or sense
that's
of
true.
History.
Of course, it was someone with
no
taste.
Before we get into the meat and potatoes of Rockefeller Center, have you seen images of Jeff Koons' newest work to debut publicly in some sort of desert? I'm not even sure which one.
Yeah, it's fucking lit. It's awesome. I fucking love it.
It is perhaps the most cursed art object I've ever seen. It is truly horrendous. It's like this chromed out. I don't even remember. It's not flowers, but it's clearly a Jeff Koons. You know what it is. But it has real, real, real strong vibes of you're my one of our favorite contemporary artists, Mr. Alec Monopoly, to it.
He's on his just peak boomer shit, man. Koons is just on some fucking insane shit right now.
It is peak boomer, isn't it? That's a really good analysis.
That's really what
it is.
Yeah, he's probably a fan of Alec Monopoly, as we are,
That's a 92nd Street Y talk I would go to. Alec Monopoly and Jeff Koons in conversation.
I don't even know if Alec Monopoly can speak English. Like
zero idea. Certainly not the Queen's English.
Well, I think there's only one man who can put those two people together, and it's Adam Lindemann.
Oh, well, he would definitely have to be the moderator. Oh, my God. I'm seeing it already. I'd like to get a piece of the back end for the documentary that's going to be made about this event. We were there first. Nate Freeman, I have him in literal stitches. I might have to pause it to get him together.
Nothing just brings me unmitigated joy like my two favorite artists, Jeff Koons and Alec Monopoly. And our favorite person, Adam Lindemann. So that was just really wonderful for me.
Bringing it back, I was not able to attend the auction on Wednesday evening at Christie's, the Allen Collection. honestly, I just had better things to do. I watched some of it on the screen. You know, if you're not bidding in these things, I find them a little bit long and tiresome. You were there.
I was there.
Give us a scene report. Rolling up, like, what'd you do beforehand? Like, what'd you see? Like, paint me a little picture, maybe above and beyond what you're able to get into the column this week.
Well, rolling up to Rockefeller Center a little bit early, I thought that it would be a good idea to stop by a friend of the pod, Ignacio Matos's wonderful rock center, Trattoria Lodi, which is a place that both of us know and love. And, you know, of course, there were a few art world people there having cocktails before the sale. Who was there? Our friend Harry Scrimgauer of David's Werner Gallery.
Formerly of David's Werner
Formerly
Gallery.
Formerly of David's Werner
he's
Gallery.
He's in town. He's out of Poland, where he was doing some refugee support work for the past, like, 6 months.
I want to give Harry a shout out because he's really doing God's work now. I mean, it's really incredible what he's done over the last...
One of the best human beings in the world, full stop, working on behalf of a charity that I believe is named after his late mother.
Mm-hmm. So good to see him briefly. Great that he's back in town. Who else was there? Rick Capolazzo of his... Aunt Amy Capolazzo's wonderful art advisory.
And so much more, whatever so much it is.
They're doing some crazy shit over there. I mean, like, I talked to Amy a little bit about it the other day. It's really exciting.
Obviously. And she had just popped back. I know she was at the sale. She might not have been at Lodi. She'd been in Hong Kong for the rugby match, like,
that's true.
Hours before, it right. seemed like.
Yeah, and she was just fresh as a daisy at Rock Center in the James Christie room. Who else was there? As you walked in, of course, you know, all the normal heads were there, from Tobias Meyer to...
This is not Lodi. We're moving over to Rockefeller. We're moving into Christie's
now. We had a drink.
What'd you have as your drink pre-sale?
I had a martini, and I had some delicious hams. There was an array of hams that Rick generously offered me because he couldn't finish it himself.
Oh, yeah. I love to see friends helping friends. Mm-hmm.
And so after that little snacky and a little martini snack, it was on to... Christie's, where all the normal heads were in attendance, some big dogs.
Did it feel always an evening sale at Christie's or either of the two main houses feels special as you're walking in? You can feel palpably feel the excitement, you know, friends greeting friends, all that. Did it feel even more so just because the level of the work? I mean, they had kitted out all of Christie's showrooms with kind of, like, you know, branded Allen stuff. Did it feel even more special? Or
yeah, I mean, it did. I mean, having gone to see the collection, I guess a week earlier, and just seeing the lines to get in, you know, if you were a member of the public, there was a palpable energy around this collection. And I think just, the acknowledgement that regardless of what happened, you were going to be witnessing history was definitely there. And also, which was interesting, usually they play some, like, sort of, you know, elevator music-y, like, classical music. Mm-hmm. They were just rocking the Eagles and Hendrix and Cream.
Well,
you know.
I mean, Mr. Allen was a huge fan of the rock and roll of the post-war kind of 60s, 70s, and on rock and roll. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a musician himself, quote-unquote.
Mm-hmm. And so it felt a little off to be in that room, you know, listening to All Around the World. Jesus Christ.
Was that a Hendrix song?
I don't know. I'm not a boomer.
Listening to White Room by Cream, they played that when there's usually, you know, some...
Do you think it was one of the versions? From what I understand, he would oftentimes bring in professional musicians from these bands like Cream into his very high-end home recording studio, have them lay down the track as it was on the album, and then he would go in later and basically do kind of instrumental karaoke over top of it. Do you think it was one of those or the OG version?
I think it was the OG versions. I don't know if they had the access to those recordings, to be honest. But on that note... If you're worth $47 billion and you were an amateurish guitar player, wouldn't you fucking hire, you know, vaccine-denying Clapton to come and, you know, lay down some tasty licks for you?
100%. I mean, I'm not sure why he wasn't in the sales room laying this down live, like, as people shuffled in.
Does he have any Richters left?
I bet you he does, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he sold a lot of those fucking Richters.
He's made, Eric Clapton has made a lot of money. You know, let's just not speak his name on the podcast.
Yeah,
anymore.
I mean, like, obviously, fuck that guy. Like, you know, tears in heaven, motherfucker.
He's a bad person.
We come for Clapton on this podcast. This is true.
You taught me this. I learned watching you, Dad.
Mm-hmm. No, we come for Clapton on this podcast.
Anyway, so you're in the sales room. It settles down. It's buzzing. People finally sit in the seats. It started about 8 minutes late, which is relatively on time.
Sale. They were very insistent that it would start on time. Of course, it didn't. You know, but, you know, it wasn't 20 minutes late. It was like 7 minutes late. things were slow in a good way because there was a fuck ton of bidding on those opening lots. You know, it went really slow. I think it took maybe an hour just to get through the first 10, 12 lots.
Now, I was surprised when I tuned in to the opening lots and Juicy, the worldwide, I'm not sure what his title is, but the main auctioneer, like the big dog, like the ace,
was not
in the rostrum.
Adrian Meyer was, which was surprising to some people, but, you know, I don't know how, you know, Guillaume and the big guy upstairs really organized shit. But, Adrian Meyer started off. He did a good job, but, yeah.
He was a little slow. So, yes, there were a lot of bids, but he certainly waited for extra bids to come
in. UC is pretty much the unparalleled master at moving things along, and he just has this really wonderful impatience about him that I think is very effective in getting people to bid because they know that the gavel will go down.
I would be so scared of holding him if I was on the phone bank, if I was trying to give him the hold signal, like the eye contact, the icy stare he gives you. I don't want to be in that fucking laser beam.
Oh, my God. It seems fucking terrifying. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how they keep their nerve, those guys. Adrian did a good job moving things along. And then I think 20-something lots in, UC took the rostrum himself. There was a switcheroo.
Throw in the Iceman. They should have played some reliever music, but they did it pretty subtly.
Bow, 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 bow. Yeah, I mean, they should have just chimed that in.
And and after the fact, I think you folks over in the press pen or whatever they call it, sort of found out why, maybe, or perhaps why there had been a change.
Yeah, I mean, maybe UC wanted to preside over the sale as it passed from 9 figures to 10 figures, making it the first $1 billion auction.
Over $1 billion. This is incredible.
It's insane.
I believe there were 5 lots when things were all said and done, 5 lots that clocked in over $100 million.
Yeah, and so many more. In that, you know, 20 million to 80 million range.
I'll tell you what, children, I remember when a $100 million picture meant something.
I know. It was crazy to watch something sell for over $100 million and people were like, okay. Kind of shrugged.
And then, you know, there wasn't on those bigger lots, which most, if not all of them, were estimate upon request, there wasn't a ton of what we would call depth of bidding, but there was clearly some competition.
There was, yeah.
I felt like there were definitely a couple of pictures that maybe the guarantor ended up, you know, at that level.
I think a few, but not all of them. And
no, definitely not.
And so that's what was exciting to see, you know, some jousting going on for the Surratt between Jin Lee and one of her colleagues was very exciting, you know, legitimately exciting. And that is not necessarily what I was expecting. I kind of thought that things were sort of all pre-sold and, like, you know, had their third parties, and that's basically who we go to. But it was a really, really lively, exciting
and
sale.
I was nervous. Like, the economy is not great. The markets are not in fuego, really.
Yeah.
And but clearly there is a level of people where when there is a very, very special once in a lifetime opportunity to acquire a work where similar copies are only existing in museums, and this is the only one possible in private hands, they're willing to dig deep and go for it. And that shows a real love of art, because these aren't investments at some point. They might be stores of capital. They might be a safe haven for capital, but they're not really investments. But to be able to say, no, I need to have this. I mean, there's a certain sickness to this, and I mean that in the most loving, beautiful way. Sort of, I need this thing, and I can't let it go by.
Right. I mean, yeah, it really was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get, you know, a Cezanne, you know, from that series. It's literally impossible. You know, to get a Surratt.
You love to see it. Yeah. You love to see it. All the usual people were in attendance at the sale, it seemed like.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you didn't have Larry, you know, buying the whole sale as he did in past seasons, but he was bidding a little bit. Christoph Venneweg was bidding. I mean, a few other people from the audience, but mostly on the phones.
Yeah, listen, we can subscribe to the bare facts if we actually care. speaking of which, actually, there was one name that kept that was a couple of new names, and perhaps because this is more kind of immod stuff than what we are always used to. A couple of new names that I noticed that were bidding on things. If you will, and maybe you know something about it. Who is Deborah Robinson?
You know what, I was not familiar with the name, and I'm still not entirely familiar.
Art market advisors, from what I can tell in my Googling, She's mostly acts as a fiduciary. She comes from the trust and estates world for many, many years at a couple of the big auction houses. And so I think maybe it might be a case of a lawyer reaching out to her and just having her act as an agent within the sales firm.
Okay.
Just to provide a firewall so that no one guesses who the buyer is. I could be wrong. Deborah might have a whole bunch of billionaires, but she bought a Calder, Hockney, O'Keefe, a few other things.
Yeah.
Other notable bidders, friend of the pod, Erica Samuels, purchased the Martin for $5 million. I believe this is a hammer price. And who else? Gabriella Palmieri.
Yep, Gabby
took down something. I don't even remember what. And Stavros from LA, Stavros Mangeros, husband to Honor Fraser, a great art collector himself, took down some things as well.
And also friend of the pod, Alex Marshall, got that big Martin, the really beautiful one.
That's true. That's true. It was good to see him get his hand up in the air there.
Yep, really great. But
everyone looked cute. Everyone looked all done up. But everyone looked great. That was on the phone banks. I liked some of the fits, especially on the ladies. There's a couple great earring situations I was drawn to, and you see that a lot because they're on the phone. So I think a dangly statement earring is really important when you're bidding on the phone in an evening sale these days, now that they're really televised events. But the sale ends up clocking in at just about $1.5 billion.
Unbelievable.
You know what you should be wearing if you're working in the auction house in an evening sale when you have an estimate of for a sale over $1 billion? Evening wear. I want to see some dinner jackets. I want to see fucking black tie. I want to see the gentlemen in tuxedos, the ladies in gowns. No excuse.
I've been thinking about this a lot. I do recall, I think in 2015, the estate of former Sotheby's owner, Alfred Taubman, was black tie.
Black tie, indeed.
It was a black tie sale, and people dressed up. And there was cocktails before. There was a lot of food. It was very fancy, and it was really fun. It was a great event.
This is an event, and it should be dressed for as such. Especially if you're up there doing the selling or placing.
Right. It's like people used to wear suits to fly. They should be wearing tuxedos to an auction.
And this used to be the norm for any evening sale. A good friend of the pod and friend of mine, Henry Alsop, used to have an amazing picture in his office of his father, who is a big auctioneer, in the day at Christie's and eventually ran the house, I think. At some big evening sale, he's up in the rostrum doing the auction in black tie, all the specialists. And I think if my memory serves me correctly, most of the audience also in evening wear.
So this is a free idea. It's not even an idea. It's kind of a demand, really.
Yeah, that's like idea. Fuck that.
Next time there is a big special sale for an estate, and there will be one probably, in May, if not November next year, make a black tie. Sotheby's, Christie's, listen to us here on the podcast. Make it black tie. We'll come in tuxes.
Hundo P, no excuses. I think that wraps up, but this is just the first of what is a very long week of auctions that lies ahead of us.
We got more billions to sell next week. There's some crazy stuff coming up. We're going to have a great podcast with our favorite auction superstar and mega brain, Lock Kressler.
Yeah, Lock Kressler is going to come in and throw down the knowledge on us. I think we'll record on Monday. I'll hopefully get it up next week, early in the week before the sales as well.
But there's also so much going on in New York. There's so many shows opening. There's galas. It's gala season, as you're well
Isn't
aware.
Isn't it always gala season?
It's always gala season.
Did we talk about the Hort Gala already?
I don't know if we did. I was not in attendance. You were?
I was there. That was a black tie event. I had the fucking penguin suit on.
Let's go.
You know it. As did just about everyone else. It was a very nice event. It was very touching and sad because obviously the charity, the Rembrandt Hort Mann Foundation, is named after the daughter of the Horts, who passed away of cancer 25 years ago or so, and has a foundation that honors her. But just in the past several weeks, their son passed away of cancer as well. So it had that feeling over the whole event. So it's hard to talk about it in any sort of jovial or usual joking way, but it was very effective. It was very long. Yes, friend of the pod, Sarah Friedlander, did a fantastic job auctioning off some stuff in a tough room. But yeah, so that happened. I feel like that was a million years ago. But on to, somewhat happier subjects. You and I got to hang out last night.
We did. We went to a really fun dinner party. I think they call them cocktail dinatoires if you're being a fucking asshole.
Wow, really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, the sort of past dinner, if it's fancy. But yeah, we went to dinner for Sterling Ruby, who has a fabulous show open now. Go see it at the Gagosian Gallery on 21st Street.
It is incredible. I'm a big fan. I'm a homer for him. I fucking stand for him. I think he's, you know, one of the greatest artists of my generation. But hasn't had a show in New York City in a gallery in quite a long time. Like, I think it's over a decade.
Mm-hmm. It really has so much fucking just strength and power. I mean,
it's a painting show. It's a raw painting show, and it's in a gallery that has a history of hosting very important exhibitions of painting.
Historical exhibitions.
The 21st Street space, mm-hmm. I mean.
John Richardson, he put together a number of Picasso shows there that I recall. But it's a really fucking ballsy space to have a painting show because it has to carry the entire weight
of the space. And it's just paintings. You know, Storing's obviously known for being really across media, from drawings to clothing lines, and certainly a lot of sculpture, which I'm a big fan of, but this really just focuses on a body of paintings, and they really just speak to themselves because they're raw dog up there. There's nothing to protect them in terms of, like, you know, you just walk in and you see all, I want to say 8 paintings, but I could have my math wrong.
That sounds about right.
And they reflect in this kind of polished concrete floor. I think it's an incredible exhibition. You know, I hope people give it the attention that it deserves. But and I know that the market is, because just here as we're sitting here recording, I got a text message that a painting I was considering but hadn't yet pulled the trigger on was sold.
Wow.
And I think it's pretty close to a sellout, it seems like.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's going to be a very quick sellout. These are fabulous paintings. I mean, they're just...
But the dinner was great because it was, you know, I actually almost canceled because I thought it was going to be a seated formal thing, and I just wasn't in the mood yesterday, wasn't feeling it. I found out there was more of a past cocktail, you know, past hors d'oeuvres cocktail. And I was like, well, that's fine. You know, it can be a little weird. Mm-hmm. But no, this was the best of both worlds. And there was It the Nines, a friend of the pod, even if he doesn't know it, John Nydick's great restaurant.
John Nydick might not listen to this podcast. Maybe he does. I haven't asked him.
In the former Great Jones space. Mm-hmm.
The Nines, it's the downtown Bevelman's that actually works.
Yeah, you know? Really, really great restaurant. But this was perfect because they cleared out all the tables except for the booths around the side. Mm. You walk in, you get the full bar. People are having their drinks. They kept the Diet Coke flowing real fast and real cold.
1942 flowing for daddy here.
Indeed. I saw lots of martinis in the crowd because it's a room that really begs for martinis. You get the piano player with the baby grand, tinkling the ivories.
And then
all of a sudden, art starts coming out, like these, like, kind of latke potato pancakes with a ton of caviar on them.
So good.
We had some foie gras. Mm-hmm. It was a massive, I didn't see this until I was on my layup, this massive charcuterie kind of station you could help yourself to.
I didn't even get to that.
I grabbed a couple pieces of cheese while I waited for my Uber.
Love it.
Not gonna lie.
I had some shrimp.
But then I didn't realize this. I missed the shrimp. You sat down and they would just bring over, like, plates of the assorted crudités and hors d'oeuvres. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, you know what, I was sitting with a couple of other people. Could we grab a couple burgers or send the burger guy over? No, they just dropped a whole platter of, like, 12 mini burgers.
Unbelievable. We were just being spoiled.
It totally spoiled. Brought over, like, 2 things of fries. It was incredible.
Yeah, fries. There was some delicious truffle pasta that was going around.
And everyone was there. People that bought from the show. A lot of Gagosian staffers in attendance. A lot of artists, both from the Gagosian stable and otherwise, and of course Sterling.
It was a really convivial mood, really. I think everyone was just in a great, great state of mind.
I think everyone's excited that they didn't have to sit in the same seat next to someone they've been assigned to sit next to, make fucking small talk. They can kind of meet some new people, cycle about, hang out with their friends. It felt like absolutely perfect, at least for my vibe.
There's so many galas and so many, like, quite fancy seated dinners for galleries and for whatnot. You know, I think that breaking it up with something like this is very nice.
You know, the night before, I've been lucky enough to have a tete-a-tete dinner at one of our favorite restaurants, Corner Bar.
Love it.
Keeps getting better. It's the same menu, but it just keeps getting better. Because I realized, as the colleague I was having dinner with and I discussed, it's the perfect menu for us.
Right.
Shrimp cocktail, Caesar salad, steak or chicken, side of fries, and some greens.
I get the same thing every time, and I love it even more every time I go. I mean, it's just, I think, talking to people who live in LA, who live in London, they want an Ignacio restaurant so fucking bad in those cities. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just trying to get him to come and open a restaurant for them so badly. So the fact that we can go to Dime Square and eat the simplest, best food that we could possibly find cooked by Ignacio is, we're just spoiled.
They should talk to our friend Keith McNally about the challenges of running a cross-Atlantic restaurant empire. Because I think it's hard to keep the quality up and get the vibe the same.
Oh, it's incredibly difficult. I'm just saying that we're lucky that we live in the greatest city in the world with the greatest restaurants in the world. And we should not take that for granted.
Extra lucky that we have the bat phone.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I forget that you can't really get a reservation there if you're not us.
Exactly. So you mentioned that it's gala season, and I mentioned to you in passing, I won't say about which gala, that, you know, I was thinking about what amount of a check would it have to land in my pocket for me to attend it. I decided for five grand, I'll leave my house and go to these.
All right, I'm not going to name that one. But yeah,
tell me in general, what's coming up? What are you going to?
What am I going to? Well, tonight it is my beautiful wife Lucy's birthday. So
happy
everyone who's
birthday,
listening,
Lucy.
Even if it's a day or two late, just reach out to Lucy, say happy birthday. You know, she loves her birthday. It's a fabulous day, and we are going out to dinner at the world famous downtown sushi restaurant Time, that is conveniently owned by her brother Nick Poe.
Will Lady be joining you for dinner?
I think not. We're actually trying to figure that out. I think that we're getting a babysitter, but she might come just to hang out,
just to stop and chat.
Yeah, just to check in.
Lady's already queen of the stop and chats, no doubt.
I'm very excited to have some fabulous sushi. I mean, the place is great. I don't know if you've been, but it's really, really fun. And
not yet. I can't get a reservation. Hook a brother up.
You know what? You know who to call.
I know.
It is a tough table, actually. It's always just super packed. So very excited for that. And then, let's see, Sunday we are going to the Swiss Institute Gala, which I'm very excited for. It's honoring Urs Fischer, and I think that Jamian had something to do with, like, designing the thing, which I don't know what the fuck that means, but I'm very intrigued. And, you know, I had the pleasure of meeting the new director, Stephanie, at another function I went to a few weeks ago. She was there with the Swiss Institute benefactor Maya Hoffman, great friend of the pod. Maya, what's up? I know you're listening.
Always. Get lots of texts from her about it.
And they just convinced me and Lucy that we had to be there.
Well, listen, I back up a little bit. I didn't realize that Simone Cassettes was no longer the director of the Swiss Institute.
No, he's now the chairman of the board of the Swiss Institute, but he's not the director.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I think just a little change of position, you know?
Love that space. Is it in the space, or where do they hold this?
No, it's at the Angel Orensans Foundation, which is that old synagogue.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
On fucking
been to many
Norfolk.
A gala there.
Yeah. Beautiful space. Beautiful place. The after party is at La Caverna, which is...
Whoa, flashback.
I know.
Literally.
I know. Yeah. for those...
Was that a Whitney after party?
It was a Whitney Vail after party. One of the most consequential parties of the last 5 years, I think.
Say more.
Well, it was a party hosted by Whitney Biennial 2019, May, April, whatever, hosted by Clearing, Lomax, Karma, maybe another gallery I'm forgetting. Anyway,
okay. Yeah.
And someone was handing out a lot of mushrooms, I believe.
Chocolates, sweets.
Mushroom chocolates, yeah. Am I allowed to say that on the podcast? Whatever.
Of course.
I didn't have any. It was the party where, friend of the pod, James Cardoso Schaefer met his wife, or something, or like their second
deep
date.
In their relationship,
and also the party where friend of the pod Sam Parker met his now wife Madeline Hollander.
Wow, I didn't know that. I do remember a very interesting ride back from Lower East Side to my house on the Upper East Side, where I insisted that the Uber driver plug my phone in so we could listen to a whole bunch of hippie music really loud.
That sounds really fun.
It was really fun. It was great.
That was also the Whitney Biennial where we went to get drinks at the now defunct Major Food Group restaurant underneath. All right, this is too much flash for a pass. We're really off topic here. Oh, La Caverna is the after party for the Swiss Institute Gala.
Yeah. It's in the off topic parts where all the good parts happen.
Yeah, clearly
it's in the spaces in between in life, not the main event.
Mm-hmm. And then Monday is the fabulous gala for Dia.
Is it up in Beacon or here in the city?
It's in the city. The one in the spring is up in Beacon.
Yeah, I won't be at either of those.
Oh, okay, well, just
it's a
put
busy
it out
auction
there.
Week. I gotta prep first of all just for our conversation with Locke. He always brings reams of data and research to
the
table.
It's unbelievable.
I'm gonna sit down a little bit on Sunday and do some of my own research so I can actually you know, sound like I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so many auctions next week. I can't even imagine. I'm trying to wrap my head around it. But it's going to be nuts.
So, and we're going to have a couple podcasts, so stay tuned. And I think that's all that was on our agenda for today, right?
I believe so. I mean, there's some stuff opening tonight that I'm probably not going to get to. Curry Manzuto is opening their Chelsea gallery tonight.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Very big deal. There is a lot of stuff opening. I can't even remember. It's crazy.
It's Friday. Come on. Shabbat dinner. Can't go to an opening. With that.
Yeah, well, congrats to the Kerman Zoo team. I'll check it out at some point.
Happy birthday, Lucy.
Happy birthday, Lucy.
Out.